Blog Talk Radio.
Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly, your host, and it is Thursday, October 9th, 2008. And Grant is not with us tonight. He is doing a lecture at the University of South Florida, I believe. And so we have a guest co-host with us tonight, Mike Jones, who's been on the program. Welcome, Mike.
Hello, everyone.
And, you know, I was thinking, Mike, that we had the show last week on Doomsday Sayers and all these doomsday prophecies, and the world's going to end, we're all going to die if we live long enough, that sort of thing. And, you know, October 7th was supposed to be a biggin.
Oh, yeah.
And I, from everything I could see, nothing really significant happened. Now, we do have next Tuesday, the 14th, when the huge UFO is supposed to be over the Southern Hemisphere in Alabama.
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah, the Southern Hemisphere in Alabama. Okay, so we'll be looking out for that one, and I'm not going to hold my breath. But anyway, it's good to have everybody with us tonight. We've got an interesting show with Dale Kaczmarek, Excursions into the Unknown. A lot of good information I know is going to come out of this. We invite you to join us in the chat room. Ask questions in the chat room if you'd like to call in live. We'd love to take your calls. The number is 347-945-7799. It's there on your screen. And you can even use that click-to-talk button if you have a headset and you're online, and we can take your calls that way as well. Let me tell you a little bit about Dale. Dale Kaczmarek is president of the Ghost Research Society and director of Excursions into the Unknown, Inc., the only year-round ghost tour of haunted Chicagoland locations. Dale has been actively investigating ghosts, hauntings, poltergeist phenomena since 1975, so he's been at it a few years, and is active in a number of organizations, including the American Association for Electronic Voice Phenomena, Society for the Investigation of the Unexplained, International Fortean Organization, and the prestigious Ghost Club of England. His website is ghostresearch.org, and we'll mention that more. It's one of the most active of its kind anywhere in the world. Dale has appeared in numerous books, publications, newspapers, and periodicals. He's been a guest on Oprah, Encounters, Sightings, The Other Side, Rolanda, Mysteries, Magic, and Miracles, Exploring the Unknown, and was called by the Discovery Channel to help produce and appear in two segments, Real Ghost Hunters and Phantom Photos. He's the author of four books, with one on the way, including Windy City Ghosts, Windy City Ghosts 2, Field Guide to Spirit Photography, and Illuminating the Darkness, The Mystery of Spook Lights. Dale, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here tonight.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You've got a book on the way, too. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I've had so many people have been prying me to get this new book out, and it's been something that's been on the back burner for a number of years, but I'm writing another field guide, part of the field guide series called A Field Guide to Ghost Hunting Techniques, which is going to be basically how to properly investigate a case using equipment, to do EVP and photography correctly, and also to properly interview, and just the whole MO of ghost hunting, because I'm not going to mention any names, but just in just looking in the past and how people do things, there's so many things that I see out there that possibly just contaminate investigations, the way people do these investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to just kind of show people what works for us. And I've been involved for so many years, and we seem to get very good results in our investigations and just using the techniques that I've developed over the years. And it's, you know, kind of a going up to the ranks myself, just going through different organizations, reading books, taking courses in the subject, and just finding out what things seem to work and what things don't work. And that's what I'm going to try to put in the book and try to point out so everybody has that information, and hopefully it'll better the community as a whole.
Sounds good. Well, you've been doing it, as you said, a year or two. Now, you started in 1975. And, you know, that was a year or two ago. Tell us how that all came about. I mean, that's longer than most.
Yeah, well, basically, I can kind of blame this spooky hobby of mine on my parents for telling me ghost stories when I was a youngster. That's really how it got
started.
Blame
the parents.
It always is. My mom and dad used to, my dad's favorite thing to do on a date with my mom after riding around, ballroom hopping or whatever, was to ride around a very famous place here in Chicago called Resurrection Cemetery to look for the ghost of Resurrection Mary, the hitchhiking ghost story. And my mom was absolutely terrified by this, of course. Of course, my dad was out there trying to find out these things were really true. So these are the kind of stories I kind of grew up with as throughout my teens and childhood years. And later, as I began to hear more and more stories in the Chicagoland area, just the places and events and bits of newspaper articles, books, and TV shows, I wanted to find out if these stories were really true or if they were simply folk tales, legends, or just outright falsehoods. And it really became quite involved in just tracking down these stories. It just started out very quite innocent for me, just putting an ad in some local newspapers out here. Opened up a P.O. box and just said, send me your ghost stories. This is long before the World Wide Web was even what it is today. They were just some BBSs, bulletin board services that were out there at that time. And I was really amazed by the amount of people that sent me pictures and accounts and personal adventures that they'd had at places, you know, not only around the Chicagoland area, but all around the world. And I began to look into some of these sites. And back about 1977, we developed a kind of a loosely associated group of people. At that time, it was simply called the Ghost Trackers Club. And it was just a number of people that had like-minded interests in the subject. And we began searching and looking at some of these sites. And about 5 years later, we actually formed the group that's now been going since 1982, actually, the Ghost Research Society.
Wow. So you've probably done a case or two in that time, huh?
Yes, actually I have. I've been all across the country in locations. I've been out to England and Wales on several different times, exploring places out there. I've been into places like Civil War battlefields, many of them are very, very famous, Gettysburg, Chickamauga, Stones River, Shiloh, places like that. I've been to places such as where spook lights are sometimes seen or ghost lights. Been to very, very famous places like the Sarah Winchester Mystery House and other locations.
San Juan.
All around the world, pretty much here in the United States when I was doing vacations, just kind of going from place to place and looking into, checking with people and talking about their encounters. And so it's been something that's taken up a lot of my spare time, as you might imagine.
Yeah. So have you had a chance to visit Lepp Castle by chance?
Which castle?
Lepp Castle in England. That's
no,
one of those.
Actually, I missed that one, actually. I did. Well, I was able to see the very famous Tower of London, Westminster Abbey, St. Paul's Cathedral. I was able to see haunted Highgate Cemetery. Which had a reputation of actually having a Highgate vampire that was actually occasionally. There's a couple of books written about that subject. But Never heard that at that particular castle. There's so many actually in England.
I spent
several months in England, probably not see every haunted site.
So were you able to see anything or experience anything in the Tower of London?
Not really. When you go, of course, no matter what day of the week you go there, it's just a barrage of people. It's not the proper conditions under which these events usually take place. So many people going through at one time. We were able to talk to some of the beefeaters there that give the tour, the guides, the tours through the various locations, including Tower Green, where many of the royalty was actually beheaded, including Queen Anne Boleyn, Catherine Howard, and Lady Jane Grey. And even the chapel, St. Peter at Vincula, which is right in Tower Green, where they actually found, allegedly, the body of Queen Anne Boleyn many centuries later, buried underneath the floor. But nothing apparently really happened, but I did talk to a number of people who spend a lot of time there. Some of the Royal Guards, or Beefeaters, as it's sometimes called, they've often had experiences, and there are many different sightings that still occur in the Tower of London, including the ghost of Sir Walter Raleigh, who was actually later beheaded, another victim of what they call political intrigue. He wasn't guilty at all, but just was later beheaded, and he used to take a daily walk along the ramparts. And his ghost has sometimes been seen still taking a walk back and forth between two towers. Queen Anne's ghost has been heard screaming down the hallway as she was trying to plead for her life the day before she was executed. And sometimes they've seen the screaming figure of a woman dressed in white running down the corridor in the middle of the night. And lots of really strange things. It's truly a place that if you've never been there, you have to experience it.
Sharon in chat would like to know if you've been to Chillingham Castle by chance.
No, I have not. Again, that's one of those that didn't get a chance to see, unfortunately. I was actually quite lucky the first time I went in 1985. I was on a ghost hunt with a two-week excursion with the chairman of the ghost club at that time, Tom Parrott, a very articulate individual, and he had been a chairman for that club for a long, long time. That goes all the way back to the 1860s. It had such people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Harry Price and many other very famous investigators and VIPs of that time period. And we were able to actually tour places the entire 2 weeks, just going in kind of a minivan and actually spending the night in haunted castles, haunted buildings, and kind of dining with some local royalty at some events and some venues, I should say. We are actually able to spend the night in a building where I didn't have the encounter, but one of the other people that were in the group actually had an encounter. It was a stately home way out in the middle of the Cotswolds, and he had to share a communal bathroom across the hallway, and as he was coming back, he basically saw a woman on the staircase and screamed like a little girl, and everybody ran up there, and of course just that quickly he was gone. But he was quite sure he had seen something, and there had been reports in the past of a phantom lady or a phantom woman of some kind seen in that building. Nobody seemed to know who she was.
That's interesting. Well, Sharon in chat also has another question. Do you think there's been an increase in paranormal events since the time you began, like today, in these recent times? Has there been an increase, or is it just that we hear more about it?
Well, that's kind of a trick question. I think it's yes to both. I mean, basically, there has been an increase, and we are hearing more about it. I think only because of the way Hollywood has treated ghosts in recent years, going all the way back to 1984 when Ghostbusters came out.
Right.
And that kind of showed the humorous side of ghosts, that they weren't always something to be frightened of or to be fearful of. And then, you know, modern-day stories like Ghosts with Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore, The Others with Nicole Kidman, White Noise, Sixth Sense, and many others treated, and even Poltergeist, for instance, the first Poltergeist, not the follow-ups.
Right.
The first one actually treated them where they were real, kind of gave you a feel for what ghosts really were and how they became ghosts and some of the methods employed to investigate them in some aspect. But because the way Hollywood has done that, and kind of in the past people would not really always talk about their ghost stories because they would, first of all, think that, well, their neighbors would think that they're crazy. Here come them with the white coats, you know, they could be locked up, they're losing it. Now it's become, I believe, because of not only Hollywood, but shows on TV, the internet, sightings, unsolved mysteries. That's incredible. Different shows like that that got the normal everyday person to tell their story without fear of being laughed at or ridiculed. I think so many more people are now telling their story, and that way there are basically, to answer the question, more people telling it and more things actually happening because more people are not so much keeping them all bottled up as they used to in the past.
So more people are reporting it, so that would be responsible for the increase.
Yeah, I believe so. And, you know, you got to also remember the world we live in today is much more of a violent world than it was when I was growing up. I mean, I could literally walk down the street, and I remember very distinctly walking down the street when I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old, and when it was dark, and I didn't have to be worried about being picked up, abducted, or whatever. Now, I mean, you got drive-by shootings, you have terrorist attacks, you have so much violence in the world, and violence very often leads to ghosts, untimely death, murder, suicide. You know, people not necessarily leaving the earth when they were supposed to. Maybe it was an accident, maybe something untimely, and because of that, you know, many spirits become trapped or earthbound and are kind of hanging around and don't realize that they have passed on, and that has been displayed in many movies in recent years, that unknowing that you're a ghost, basically, you kind of experience it a bit further down.
Now, in your investigations, do you also resolve hauntings? I mean, and I'm talking about true ones, that where you actually do find paranormal activity. Do you guys go that to that extent, or how do you go about when there actually is some, you know, some paranormal activity going on? I mean, you can't really explain it. You've ruled out all the natural explanations. Where do you guys go from there?
Well, we do and have on occasion worked with some very gifted psychics and intuitives. In fact, several in our group, I won't say are psychic, but they are somewhat intuitive, and we do use their feelings as well. Of course, when we bring in, let me just backtrack a little bit, when we do bring in people to an investigation, and this is something I mentioned in my book that is got to be, you know, on the top of the list for everybody. There should be only one person that knows what's going on, the person that interviews these people, and that's usually myself.
Right.
If you have a designated interviewer, that person should be the only person. The rest of the group should come in basically without knowing anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming into a place that's haunted. They know that there's something going on.
Or purportedly anywhere.
When we get to the point when there may actually be something there that we can't explain away, where we have very strong evidence, we have EVP, we have pictures, we even have things moving around or visual sightings or very strong evidence, much more than circumstantial, then we do have people that we can bring in that claim that they can, in fact, make communication with the ghost, either clairvoyantly or telepathically in some way. And the best way I can describe what they do is they somehow communicate on their level and kind of explain to them their situation, that they're earthbound, that they need, and again, this is something I'm going to mention in my book, they don't go to the light, but they simply reach out to friends and loved ones that have passed over and just kind of move on, because this is something that this idea of going to the light is something that I've been kind of kicking around for the last 10 years when I've been hearing it. Even with the little midget psychic in Poltergeist, the little tiny woman going towards the light and so forth. We know how ghosts look to us. You know, we see them, we experience them, we've seen them in pictures, we've seen them in video, we've heard voices, we've heard sounds, but we have no idea how we look to a spirit. For all
right.
we know, we might look like a ball of light, like an energy mass, like some sort of collection of energy. So by saying, go to the light, you might be telling the spirit to attach itself to the nearest living person that they see or nearest energy source and basically telling them to stick around. So without confusing them, we just tell them to kind of reach out. Well, psychics would tell them to reach out to people
mm-hmm.
that have passed on, that
mm-hmm.
know are no longer in this physical realm. And that's one way of getting them to cross over. But again, they have their own free will.
Sure. That's interesting. Yeah, very interesting stuff. All right, so in your experience, what are some of the cases that have really made you sit up and take notice? I mean, what are some of the more interesting cases where there actually was paranormal activity? Care to expand on, you know, that taught you something?
Yeah, there were several, actually, several that really come to mind. The one probably that still, we cannot, no way, shape, or form explain this, and it was verified by at least 10 independent people. We were at, in fact, it was part of a show that may be repeated on Discovery Channel. It's the Real Ghost Hunters episode. We had a 12-minute segment on there. We were contacted by a woman named Danica Faye, which is a woman at a house in the north side of Chicago near Belmont,
uh-huh.
Harlem. And she was experiencing, we can use her name because she allowed us to use her name in the show and so forth, so there's nothing
mm-hmm.
wrong with that. But she was experiencing a lot of things that were happening to her, lights flickering off and on, things out of the corner of her eye she would see. Her pets would often react to things in the room. But the thing that really kind of made her think that something was there, in the middle of the night she woke up and she glanced at the doorway to her bedroom, and leaning on the door jamb was a man in a dark blue uniform. And she thought she was asleep. She kind of rubbed her eyes, blinked, was still there, and then it slowly just began to slowly dissolve away, and it wasn't there anymore. Now, not only that, she sometimes would complain that things would grab her feet in the middle of the night and scream in her ears. Now, her husband wasn't always at home. He had a different shift. Sometimes he would work nights. He had kind of a swing shift, so he wasn't always there when these things happened, and she thought she was going crazy. So she called us in. We began and went through a regular investigation, and this was soon after the original Sony night cams came out, the Sony night vision cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of people now find these floating orbs, which, you know, there are a lot
right.
of explanations for what these orbs could be besides dust particles
right.
and insects. But we got some that we were fairly sure were not. They didn't react at all like an insect or a dust particle. It did not even have the configuration for that. But we were contacted by the Discovery Channel. They wanted to come in. They wanted an interesting case. We mentioned about this case, of course, after we got permission from the client to come there. And they just wanted to really do a recreation of what we do, how we set up, how we investigate, how we go over information, and they didn't expect anything to happen, obviously, when they were there. But as we were setting up, you know, they had turned off some of the lights, the air conditioner, the fans, to make it quiet. And the upstairs bedrooms, the hallways upstairs, is where all this phenomena seemed to happen. So we rigged up cameras up there. We set up our Geist program, which I'll talk about that in a bit here, too. But
mm-hmm.
It's a basically a self-contained ghost hunting unit, and we set that up there, turned the lights off, shut the doors, and made sure nobody, we could see the doorway, so we knew nobody was up there, nobody had gotten up there. The pets were downstairs, it was just the cameras and the empty rooms. After about an hour and a half of waiting, suddenly we began to hear footsteps, very distinct footsteps, no mistaking. It wasn't, you know, squirrels in the attic, raccoons
right.
in the porch, or, It was definitely the hardwood floors, and it sounded like shuffling of feet on the hardwood floors. And we had a remote, remote cameras, and we had a remote recording device up there, wireless FM transmitter, which was connected to an oscilloscope downstairs, and we could see these noises were getting louder and louder. And then metallic objects began to strike the floor. Now, the camera literally faced almost every section of the upstairs, so it was nothing, if there was something physical hitting the floor, the cameras would have caught that, and yet there was nothing.
Right.
It soon stopped, and then when it stopped, in fact, if you ever see the show, you'll just before this, as the noise is going on, you'll hear a very nervous female producer whisper to me, "Dale, what's going on?" And you hear that, and I said, "I don't know. We had not heard sounds there before." We went up, I sent some of my assistants up there, told them to look around for a possible explanation, and I said, "While you're up there, shuffle your feet around the floor." And the sounds that they produced were identical. We compare them with audio spectrum analyzers, and they were identical sounds of feet actually shuffling on the floor. Then later we did get some orbs that floated through. We're not really that concerned with that, but it was mostly the sounds for a sound to be similar to shuffling of feet. To me, you'd have to have physical mass to cause that friction on the floor to make a sound, and yet there was nothing there. It had never happened before. It had never happened after. It only happened on the one time that they were there, and they were able to document that for the show. So that was one thing that really sticks out that to this day we can't figure out what caused that.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing you say. You know, you got to have physical mass to be able to make those sounds, to create that friction and noise. It's an interesting thought, you know. What is it they do? I mean, do they apparently have the ability to have an impact on matter. I mean, have you ever considered the science of that?
Yeah, we've kicked around that idea for over 12 years of sounds. While we try to do EVP, electronic voice phenomenon, as well, which is the obviously trying to get spirit voices to answer questions, and you ask a question, you leave some space, you ask a question, leave some space, and allegedly in the blank space, the answer will come, but you don't hear it until later when you play it back. We do occasionally get voices, but we do get a lot of what we call EMP, electronic noise phenomena, sounds mostly, that are just weird. And give you a perfect example, just a few weeks ago, we were in a place, a hair salon, a tanning place, in, way out in Bartlett, Illinois, and things have been happening there. Now, we had set cameras up in the back rooms, and we were all in the front, and we were absolutely quiet, and yet we still heard, on occasion, things hitting the floor. Sounded like metallic objects, or even you know how you take your finger and you hit a wine glass, a champagne glass, that makes a distinctive ding. You'd hear that, and then we actually heard two very distinct shuffles of feet back there again. Now again, they're very small rooms. There was a couple. There was a facial room, a massage room, a couple of tanning booths, and a few other little nooks and crannies back there. And for the most part, we had the majority of that area under video surveillance the entire time, night vision cameras, and nothing was seen moving around. We did actually see an insect, you know, a very nice insect fly right through the screen, a very nice orb. But, but we didn't find anything that would have created those sounds, and yet the sounds were there again of somebody, and they were hardwood floors, shuffling your feet on a hardwood floor. And it's beyond what I can comprehend as far as the science involved, because, you're talking about probably a residual haunting, something that has happened in the past that
mm-hmm.
has left behind some sort of psychic scar or, impressed
mm-hmm.
something in the fabric of time and space that replays itself under certain conditions. We don't even understand what those conditions may be. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
they coincide with anniversaries, death dates, but sometimes
mm-hmm.
they are completely random. And yet these sounds, we can't explain why or how, where a physical object strikes the floor, you hear that, or people have explained or talked to me about actually hearing dishes break, tables being pulled around, chairs being pulled around, and yet there's no dishes broke, no silver on the floor, no chairs moved, nothing moved, but you hear those sounds. So it's
mm-hmm.
almost like you're remotely looking or remotely hearing into the past of something that happened in the past that was significant.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
It'll almost be like a dimensional crossover of sorts, is what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard of the theory where people visit very, very old locations, and sometimes they will see the location of what it looked like back then, like looking through a looking
mm-hmm.
glass back in time. This is what would be the opposite, well, similar, but you'd be hearing something that happened back in time in that location. It may not even been a kitchen back then. It might not have been a beauty salon back then. It might have been something else. But because it's on the same physical property, and physical properties as well as people and buildings and inanimate objects can also be haunted, physical property can be haunted. So if you have something there, that something happened back in time, that building later torn down, something built right on that same property, same things can happen at that same physical spot.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that after the break. We are talking with Dale Kaczmarek of Ghost Research Society, and you're in the greater Chicago area, correct?
Yes, I am. I'm just outside of Chicago Southwest.
Okay, cool. So we're going to take a break just a few minutes. If you'll hang with us, we'll be right back with Dale. Hang on with us. Thank you.
The West Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for two full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And we're back. Welcome, everybody. We are having a great interview with Dale Kaczmarek. I'm here with our guest co-host, Mike Jones. Hey, Mike.
Hello, everybody.
And welcome back, Dale.
Thank you.
And just before we get into continuing our discussion, I just wanted to invite everyone to feel free to ask questions in the chat room or give us a call. The numbers are on your screen. It is 347-945-7799. And we'd love to hear your questions for Dale. Also like to remind everybody that we've got the Paranexus conference coming up in about 2 weeks or so in Tampa. It's on October 25th. If you haven't registered, we'd love to have you. The early bird special ends on, I believe it's Wednesday, October 15th. And right now it's $59 for Paranexus members, $69 for non-members. But part of the early bird special is that you get a year membership with Paranexus, which is a $30 value. So you get that included, or you get an extension if you're already a member. We'd love to have you there. It's going to be a great conference. We've got a lot of great topics planned, and it'd be a great time to network and have a little fun and share what you've learned, too. It's really a conference designed for paranormal researchers. So love to have you there. You can get more information at paranexus.org. All the details will be there. We are talking with Dale Kaczmarek from the Ghost Research Society. His website's ghostresearch.org. And we've been talking about a number of interesting things. We're talking about residual hauntings. And, you know, Dale, as you were talking about that just before the break, it really occurred to me, something I hadn't thought of before, but from a scientific point of view, you've got these residuals, these imprints, and yet they must have some kind of mass because they are at times making noises. Like you said, you're recording And I've heard this many times. You hear dishes, you hear things breaking, and nothing is obviously broken. So, you know, somehow it's so interesting to me how an imprint on the fabric of time-space or the crystalline structure or the geological structure underneath, how that can actually impact matter. Interesting thing.
Even to take a step beyond that, I was talking to your other host there just during the break too. I've been to locations and I've heard of locations and I've researched places where sometimes you will see actually an impression or depression of somebody or something sitting in a chair. The cushions actually go down. The bed actually sags. The chair, if it's a rocking chair, actually rocks. Things of that nature. Now, again, something is causing or creating something to happen to a material object in our dimension. Now, again, if you go back to quantum physics, mechanics, Einstein, you know, energy can't be created nor destroyed. It changes form pretty much, and that's all it does. But energy basically has mass in a way that we don't quite understand it. And maybe that's what we're actually picking up, is the energy in some way affecting physical objects in a way that we can't actually quite explain. Skeptics will say, there's always a logical explanation. Well, put a skeptic in a room when some of these things happen and see if they can come up with one. I'd love to hear their theory.
Yeah, I know. Don't even get me started on the skeptics and debunkers. You know, there's obviously something going on.
Yeah, debunker, I don't mind the debunkers, because the debunker actually will look for a possible natural explanation. The skeptic is really kind of a closed mind, atheistic type individual that has no preconceived beliefs one way or the other. He's just completely closed minded to everything, unless he sees it with his own eyes and can prove it under laboratory conditions. And ghosts, being a very spontaneous phenomenon, they don't always, probably never, reproduce themselves under laboratory conditions. You have to be in the field, basically, as they say, the old adage, at the right place at the right time for these things to happen, to be able to record them and gather the necessary evidence.
All right, so so have you had any other cases that involve like a malevolent non-human spirit or something that really, I guess, told you that they exist or they don't exist or whatever?
Well, one of the other cases that comes to mind, and I only wish we would have been able to do more with this, it was a very famous case. Not a lot of people are aware of the fact that we were the one and the only investigative team ever called into this specific case. It concerns what I call the Orland Hills, Illinois poltergeist case in Orland Hills, Illinois, which started off of a young girl in her teens, early teens, that apparently was living there with her parents in a brand new subdivision in Orland Hills. And if you saw this subdivision, you would swear you'd walk down to the set of Poltergeist. I mean, it looked identical to the subdivision in Poltergeist. In fact, the house that was the focus of the haunting was the first house in the subdivision to be built, just like the Freeling house was the first house in that subdivision to be built. And at that time, I was working with a very famous professional psychic. She doesn't want her name used because she works with psychic police right now, but we'll call her Trudy. And she had worked on the Atlanta child murder cases. She had worked in Chicago with the Melissa Ackerman and Janina Carrico cases, so she was well known for her psychic ability. And she called me one afternoon, and she said she had gotten a call from the Orland Hills Police Department and state fire marshals. They wanted to meet with us in Orland Hills to discuss what they considered to be beyond what they could understand. And the way she said it to me, she said, "We have the real thing here." And being, even though I was a seasoned investigator back then, it even sent kind of a shiver up my spine, thinking, what are we getting into here? But I guess the anticipation of that is, you know, something just to stir up your old adrenaline. We were called into a room, generally, and we sat in a closed conference room before they even started. They said that nothing that said in this room leaves this room. It stays here. That's how tight-lipped they were about that. And we always pledged confidentiality anyway. So they began to go over all these things that happened in this house, including strange sulfur smells that constantly break out for no apparent origin, cords plugged into microwaves inside electrical outlets would literally melt in the walls. The rubber would melt and leave behind bare wires in a puddle of this rubber on the floor. They had been called to this house no less than 30 times in 3 months to investigate sulfur smells, what was a bit of spontaneous combustion constantly going on, little fires breaking out. And in fact, while we were in the room, a call had come in. We went along with them, but we were unable to mingle with anybody or go into the house. And during this time, or this is actually after the conclusion of their investigation and the conclusion of ComEd, Hewlett-Packard, Northern Illinois Gas Company, everybody who had been out there to look for power surges, gas leaks, subterranean gas, electrical spikes, I mean, you name it, to try to figure out what was going on in this house, they couldn't come up with an explanation. What most mystified these guys, and when they were telling me these stories, these guys were literally, their face was just stone, made of stone. I mean, not a smirk, they were completely dead serious. They had got a call to go into this house. As soon as they walked in, they found a very strong sulfur smell, and they couldn't determine where it was coming from. They went upstairs because it seemed to be where it was coming from. They got to the top of the stairs. They went into a small bedroom, which apparently was this girl's room. Her name was Dina Gallo, and she wasn't there at the time. In fact, they were living with grandparents. They had literally moved out because of all the things that were happening. So the house was kind of vacant at the time. And the power to the house had been shut off. They were doing some sort of testing on the wires or something at that time. So there was no power to the house. Now, in front of two state fire marshals, my friend Steve Smith, who was an arson expert from Orland Hills, a Orland Hills police officer and a Orland Hills fire department personnel, a blue plume of flame, 3 inches in diameter, 21 inches long, shot out of the electrical outlet, power of the house shut off again. That's the main key to remember here. And actually touched and set a mattress on fire in front of their eyes. Now, they don't know what's going on, but their first instinct was there's a fire. So they had some portable extinguishers. They doused it, but it was still smoldering. Mm-hmm. They literally heaved the mattress out the window. It was a smaller mattress, like a single mattress or whatever, twin, out the window, and they doused it more heavily down there with the fire hoses. They later did some tests on it was so mystified by what they saw, they couldn't explain it. They did some tests on the mattress itself, and they had all this information, and they had a bag of evidence they were presenting in front of us at this meeting, closed meeting. And they said that this mattress was individually pocketed coil springs. The springs had literally lost their springiness. They were just strands of wire. And they couldn't explain that, but they did test or simulated tests on similar coils to determine the amount of heat and time necessary to create that or duplicate that. They determined that a temperature of no less than 3,000 degrees for 30 minutes would have created that. That mattress was on fire for no more than a few minutes. The outlet that thing shot out of, they had that in their hand. They showed it to me, and they said, smell it. It smells like pine needles. They couldn't explain it.
Well, I have
literally
a question.
Just faked it.
Right.
Go ahead.
Did anybody take it in consideration that an extreme magnetic field could be causing that situation also?
Well, they didn't, because they were just out there to investigate, again, another fire or smell or something in the house when this happened in front of them. Now, there were a number of other people and teams in there. I don't know all the teams that were in there, but I know the Comet was in there, Northern Illinois Gas, Hewlett-Packard, and others. I don't know what they found. They were very tight-lipped about this. But eventually what they did is they tore the house down completely. The Travelers Insurance Group gave the family a settlement. They moved elsewhere. They built a new house a few years later, and apparently nothing going on in that house ever since. But they did determine several things, and we did determine several things in our research. Number one, we were told that in digging that particular basement, the foundation for that basement, they did unearth human remains that were very old, maybe a small pauper cemetery or, you know, maybe a family plot that was out there. It was all farmland, you know, pretty much before Orland Hills became Orland Hills. And later, of course, when the story was broken, we didn't say anything. Somebody broke it to, of all places, the National Enquirer. And they later emphatically denied that they ever said that a body was found there. But we did determine that that area was at one time a big farmland and part of a slaughter pen for pigs and cows and so forth. So a lot of blood that was spilled, you know, on the land or on the property. But to this day, allegedly pieces rained in there, but we were never actually able to get involved specifically to do any follow-up, because the way they said it to us is, how can we go to the family and tell them that we've ruled out everything that there is to rule out, and now we're going to bring them to Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
That's how they said it, basically. You know, they were just kind of bringing us in to show us this and get our opinion and get the psychic's opinion and take it from there. And eventually, somewhere down the line, after the story was broke, I was contacted by Unsolved Mysteries. They wanted to find out the family's name, which I did give. They contacted the family to try to do a show for that, and apparently the family wanted too much money or something, and it never went through. But it was a small mini segment with Jonathan Frakes on a show called Fact or Fiction. They did show a bit of a clip of that to see if people could see if that was fact or fiction, that particular story. So it was an amazing case. It would have been interesting, fascinating to get deeper involved with this, actually the house, the people, and so forth, to see what might have been causing this, because I don't think they would have maybe approached it in the same way I would have approached it to research and investigate this particular case.
So the family didn't have any problems after they moved?
Not at all, from what I understand. It apparently, in my opinion, it may have been several things. It may have been, number one, it could have been partly due to poltergeist phenomena. There was an adolescent involved. She was 13. She was a female. And by far, there are more female adolescent poltergeist cases than there are male adolescent poltergeist cases. She might have been subconsciously or upconsciously tapping into the energies that were already there and creating more things and not knowing that she was doing them. Because many times she was there when these things happened, and sometimes she wasn't there. So there were more intense things sometimes when she wasn't there, except for the blue plume of flame, which these fire marshals could never explain, and they were quite shocked by that when they saw that. But that was something that might have been created simply by the energy that were already latent there.
Well, you know, Dr. Roll talks about almost a delayed psychokinetic reaction, even when there is an agent there. They've apparently run into that they've been able to at least surmise that that's what was going on, almost a delayed thing. So that's an interesting concept as well. I mean, if there is an agent there, it can happen even when they're not there, and yet after the family moved, you know, psychokinetic stuff, RSPK, you know, it disappears after a few months, typically. So that could have explained it, possibly.
Yeah, if you remember the very famous case that happened in Columbus, Ohio in the 1980s with Tina Resch, which was also investigated
right.
by Dr. William Rowe and other investigators,
right.
There were a lot of things going on in that house for a number of months and months and months, and it may even been even up to a year, until she allegedly broke her leg under some sort of accident. And I guess the trauma from that breaking of the leg seemed to break the psychokinetic activity that was going on, because from that point forward, nothing else happened. She was studied further by William Rowe and other parapsychologists and psychologists and so forth, but nothing else seemed to happen after that one event in her lifetime. So maybe
yeah, that's an interesting case.
Maybe there's something that something traumatic or something unusual or something untimely
mm-hmm.
or unexpected happens to the generator of that PK that creates the, you know, the shutoff switch.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Cool. So sounds like some interesting cases and so forth. We still want to talk about the Geist system you're using and talk about some other cases in which you know, it's really changed the direction of your thinking. So think about that. We're going to go to a break. We're getting toward the top of the hour, and this is a good time. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about those. So folks, hang with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam.org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of paranormal radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTradio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And we're back. This is Doug Kelly, host with my guest co-host, Mike Jones. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Doug. How's it going?
It's going good. Grant is on hiatus tonight. He's teaching some course at University of South Florida, I believe. And so he's not with us tonight, but he'll be back next week. We're also talking, of course, with our guest, Dale Kaczmarek. Welcome back, Dale.
Hello.
Yep, you are on. And we've been having a great discussion on a number of different things. We're talking about some cases, some interesting cases Dale's been on. His website is ghostresearch.org, Ghost Research Society in the greater Chicago area. He's been doing this since 1975, so it's been a year or two, and had a chance to observe quite a few things. Dale, in terms of the cases you've done over the years, what percentage, if you can give us something on that order, of cases involved so-called demonic activity or a malevolent inhuman spirit? I mean, how frequent are those in your experience?
In my experience, it has been fairly infrequently. Of course, again, it really depends on, you know, who you talk to, and there are a lot of people for just decades. Ed and Lorraine Warren were doing a lot of demonic cases. I know John Zaffis also is a demonologist. They probably come across more because their name reflects what their expertise is in that area.
Right.
Basically, I'm kind of in the area of hauntings, ghosts, poltergeist activity, where we do occasionally do get calls from people that have some very negativity or negative spirits or negative energy involved. A lot of these do tend to come through or be directly associated with things that may have happened in that abode or that area somewhere in the past, either through seances, Ouija boards, automatic writing, devil worship, black magic, or just the occult arts in general. And there have been a number of these cases that when we get, I can automatically feel, and when people begin telling me what's going on, that there's something much more than just the normal average ghost involved. There may be something. The name demon comes to mind, but I don't know if that's really a good analogy of what it really is. It's simply my beliefs in demons and in diabolical things is, shall I say, kind of on the fence, because I've not truly experienced anything like that in my work. Don't know if I want to, but
yeah.
What I normally do is, in cases that are extremely negative or sound extremely negative, what I try to do is I try to, number one, find out if there's been any church involvement Is there any kind of house blessing? Have they? Well, exorcisms is something that's, you know, way down the line before you can get somebody to do something like that. But has there been any other investigation, any house blessings, any use of any of these devices I spoke of earlier, Ouija board seances, and to find out if there's something that may have precipitated this haunting or this negative energy to kind of intercede in our dimension here. What it simply may be is just negativity. Negative energy, negative ions, something that is that seems to generate or instill fear, anxiety, depression to our psyche, and may not be really a demon, a devil, or something per se. There, we can measure with devices different forms of energy from electromagnetic frequency, radio, microwave, electric energy, static electricity, different forms of invisible energies around us, and we can often tell if an energy of an area is beyond the norm of what should be in that area just by the spikes you get on various devices. And you have to then determine if what you're getting is caused or created by the environment, the area, sunspot activity, or whatever, or a ghost or a demon or something of negative of that nature. And it's just not been my experience, though, to get involved or to have that many cases bordering on negativity. I've heard people talk about that it's probably a lot more than many people believe it to be, but it's just not been my experience. I mean, what I seem to get the majority of is people that have some sort of either poltergeist activity, a residual haunting, or what I would call an apparition, which is really rare, a real direct communication and interaction with a ghost or spirit in some way. And this can be, like I say, attached to an area, or a house, geographic area itself, a person, or even an inanimate object. We've had a number of very interesting cases involving haunted antiques and family heirlooms. One of them, in fact, I even had having inherited some haunted antiques from an investigation we did a number of years ago. This woman was an antique. She just went crazy with antiques. She would buy them everywhere she went, and her whole house was filled with them. She began to have a lot of experiences in the home. She was living there with her husband. Her mother had moved in because she was a bit elderly, and they had a 5-year-old son in the other room. And at night, she believed that several times she would get up, and she thought she saw her 5-year-old in a state of sleepwalk, heading towards the stairs, which if he would have tumbled, he could have hurt himself severely. So she would jump up, run over to the staircase, and of course there was nothing there, her son sound asleep. And this went on for a number of weeks. And there were other things going on. There were drawers that had been pulled out. There were no adolescents in the home. Nobody fitting the profile of a poltergeist, but drawers being pulled out, knives that were found stuck in the floors. There were cold spots, there were sounds, and so forth. And, of course, this apparition of this little young boy. And she called us in. We began looking through with EMF meters and so forth, and we were getting an incredibly high percentage of spikes down this one corridor that had a particularly large selection of these antiques, including a pair of angel cherubs that were on the wall. We got nothing near the floor, near the ceiling, or in the room below or the room on either side, just in that particular hallway. And nothing really came out of it as far as the video surveillance, the EVP, pictures or anything. But for some reason, when we go to locations, sometimes we can't explain it. For some reason, these areas calm down completely for months and even years. And they say, well, thank you for getting rid of the ghost. I said, well, I never did anything. I just visited your home, and it just decided to move on by itself. I don't know. But eventually, she wrote to me, or called me, I guess, and she was so sure that she knew that these angel cherubs was the cause of what was going on. She said, I'm either going to throw them away, or if you want, I can mail them to you. I said, well, okay. That might be interesting.
Sure.
If she's
really
that animate about it, bring them, you know, send them to me, and we'll maybe do a study on them or something. So she boxed them up. That was years ago. They're still sitting in a box. I haven't opened them up, and I'll explain about that in a second. But when I first got them, I put them on the front porch. Now, it's an inside porch. There's outside windows that separate the outside from the inside windows. And I was sitting in my Lazy Boy one day watching TV, and suddenly I heard a very loud rap on the inside window from the inside porch. Now, it wasn't from the outside. It was definitely on the window where those angel cherubs were. That's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So then I decided to move them. I'll leave them there for a little bit. And I went to work the next day. My wife was down in the basement doing laundry, and she heard people walking around upstairs. And it wasn't me. I hadn't come home yet. My stepson wasn't home. It was just her. And she said, oh, my God, and somebody broke in. So she was real quiet until the police finally stopped. But they were coming from the area where those angel cherubs were. So she said, get rid of those things. I said, okay, I'll put them upstairs in the attic. Lo and behold, I start hearing things up in my attic. So eventually, they quieted down completely, and I haven't heard anything. But what we're hoping to do here in the future, as soon as I find four steadfast volunteers, is I was going to box the angel cherubs in one box and make three other identical boxes and mark them A, B, C, and D, and put the same amount of wood, if you will, in the other boxes and give them to four people, switch them around for 4 weeks till everybody gets them, and then find out who has the experiences in their house without telling the person which one has the angel cherubs, kind of a double-blind test.
Yeah.
So far, I have put four volunteers that want to do that.
I'll volunteer.
but it's interesting that, you know, see, again, getting back to the idea of ghosts actually being able to be around or have their energies associated with family heirlooms or things that hold great sentimental value, that has been experienced very, very often in cases we've investigated. We actually went into an antique store. What a treasure trove of energies it was there from generations of people. And as we were going around initially doing the sweep, we're coming across all different types of readings. And later in the evening, we heard all kinds of sounds down in there. There was nobody in the downstairs part of this antique store. We later find out that in really looking carefully in this antique store, we did find an antique Ouija board. We found two authentic voodoo dolls from New Orleans. And we also found some Kachina dolls, a South American fetish dolls from South America in this antique store. So it might have had something to do with some of the activity that was going on.
I think Mike had a question early on, a part of the earlier conversation.
Yeah, this is pertaining back to the demon question. I was kind of curious, do you find in all the years of research that actually what might be going on is due to a person's belief system, and that actually interjects the negativity?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Since I've been investigating cases, we do a regular questionnaire we fill out, and everybody kind of get a profile not only of what's going on of the property, but of people's own belief systems, and we get into some specific questions. But one of the questions we ask is religion, because religion often plays a big factor in this, what your belief in religion is. And by far, more than 85% of the cases that we work with here in Chicagoland area in the suburbs where we've gotten calls from people have been Roman Catholics. Now, again, Roman Catholics, get into the area of, you know, heaven, hell, purgatory at one time, and, you know, exorcisms and Roman Catholic priests performing exorcisms.
Right.
It also has a lot to do with that. Chicago, by the way, has the largest population of Polish Catholic people anywhere in the world except Warsaw that might contribute to that being so high. But very often I do believe it is people's own beliefs too, their belief structure and what they believe in that filters in or factors into cases, by all means, yes.
Okay. There's a question also in the chat room from Sharon. She's asking about, and I don't know if you know anything about this or not, but we can throw it out there. She asked, does a spirit have weight? They weighed a dead person and they weigh less than alive. And apparently there's been some research. She gives a website where this Dr. Duncan McDougall, I believe, had a system for testing that. Are you anything in... You can comment
on it. I've
heard
of that, actually. I've heard of that allegedly at the moment of death, the body does weigh slightly less by a few grams or a few thousandths of a gram. I don't remember exactly.
It's like in half an ounce to three quarters of an ounce.
There is a weight differential at the time of death, which many people attribute to the soul, if you will, leaving the body and going on its astral journey or something. And that gets into a lot of ideals or ideology of out of body experiences, and being physically attached to the body with an etheric tail, if you will. If you somehow sever that, then you're
right.
Floating around. You're actually dead or something. It's like the spinal cord of your soul, if you will. But that plays into the same idea. And that's a fascinating whole area in itself, and I've often been asked the question too: is when people see ghosts, are they really seeing ghosts? Or are they seeing the out of body experiences or out of body
experiencers,
living people, of living people? And that's an interesting question all in itself, because if it is part of your own psyche, your soul, or personality. It could actually be perceived by people, especially those that are, very, very gifted or psychic or intuitive or at least open-minded.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing. Well, cool. So let's get into your Geist device. Can you explain a little bit what that is and what you use
sure.
it for?
Yeah, the Geist, which is basically an acronym for geophysically equipped instrument of scientific testing. Geist, of course, is the German word for ghost, as in poltergeist, was a device designed by my electronics expert, who has been with the group for about 17 years now, Stan Suho. And he actually devised several different devices, built them from scratch, using kits, diodes, and so forth from Radio Shack and other electronic stores. He built a working Geiger counter for us. He built a negative ion detector or static field detector. He built an infrared detector. And he built this whole system called Geist, which he wrote the software for, actually, as well. He wrote the program in just basic, basic computer language. Basic. But what it basically is,
Basic.
It's just basically a laptop computer that's hooked up. The laptop actually has the program on it for running the Geist device. And the Geist device is really what's called a polling box, which has a number of different PC leads into it, PC output and input switches. And
sensors.
That you can plug different devices into and spread them across the room. We have them set up currently for the Geiger counter, the negative ion detector, and the tri-field meter, but we can also hook them up to the hydrogen sulfide detector, and eventually we're trying to put together one for temperature, and maybe one even for sort of like almost like a seismograph for movements or vibrations. Which would help in the case where you would hear sounds and you should be able to find out they're actually creating the movement of the floor when they create the sound. What this does is once you turn this thing on, you spread out the equipment throughout a given location. It can go as far as the amount of cord you have. You turn this device on, you start it to monitor, and if anything goes on, basically you walk away. It's a self-contained device. It'll actually reset itself throughout the entire evening without anybody even being in the room. And what it does is it picks up any disturbances off of any of the equipment that's set up. It'll send a signal back to the laptop. The laptop will then alert, write that file to a log in the computer of what device went off, what time it went off, reset itself, start monitoring again. We actually have it set up now, one step better. We have what's called a ghost camera that is actually set up, can be put in the room with the devices, so when the devices go off, it snaps the picture. A second later, even faster than a second probably, a quarter of a second or a 60th of a second later of that device going off, and gives us a photographic picture of what might have set that device off, if there's a spirit there or something. And
sure,
the
somebody.
It will reset itself throughout the evening, 24 shots, 36, or whatever's in the camera. And then at the end of the time, you come back, look at the log, see what devices went off, look at the camera, and the camera will actually tell you, the log will tell you what picture was taken with what device going off at what time. And it's one of a kind. It was something that Stan Suho just decided to put together one day in his spare time. And we use it very extensively now in our work. We've not actually used it in the true solo mode. It can be used like that, but very often we're there monitoring it, resetting it,
sure,
tweaking it throughout the evening, because we're actually able to, as you know, the tri-field meter is by far the one device that most ghost hunters usually have in their arsenal. And it can be a device that is unfortunately so sensitive that it shouldn't really be used in a walking mode.
Right.
It's best.
And you're talking about the natural.
The
tri-field
natural. EMF meter. Yeah.
Right. Tri-field makes several units, but he's referring to the natural.
That device is so sensitive that it actually, as you're moving it around, and you know, I see that so often, that's another thing that will be mentioned in my book coming out, that you get a lot of false readings when you move around and you wave it around as you're moving it through the normal electromagnetic fields all around us. So it's best left in a stationary mode after that meter settles down, and then eventually acclimates itself to the environment and what's around it. Then if there's a change in the electromagnetic field around that device, what we watch for is that spike, that needle fluctuation, that quick movement from left to right, indicating something, some field of energy, a moving field of energy has passed in front of that meter. And that's what you should watch for. And not when the device is just going and it's just getting a static field, which is probably caused by either the sound of the device turned up too high for number one, when most people don't realize, or you're near something that's generating a very strong magnetic field, which is natural. So you want to get away from those types of devices like TVs, computer screens, stereo speakers, electrical outlets, and get into a location where you don't have contamination of natural fields, and watch for that device to go off. But that device in itself is very misunderstood, the tri-field meter, that is, because many people believe that they can move slowly around with that in a handheld mode and still get good readings. You really can't unless you're walking at a turtle's pace. And even there, you're going to get that needle to bite and to move.
Yeah, it's very sensitive.
It is. Just very recently, we came back from an investigation in Indiana, in Indianapolis, at the Morgan County Jail, which is a very haunted spot in Indianapolis. And, actually, it's just south of Indianapolis. It's in a town called Martinsville, Indiana. And our state coordinator from Indianapolis, Lisa Crick, set up this investigation. And this jail is an amazing place. It's very rundown. It's rusty bars. This one whole section of one jail section doesn't even have electric lights in it. And when we were setting up our equipment and running through there, I had never, in all my time in working with the tri-field meter, seen that device go off as it did in that jail. It was in a stationary mode. It was sitting on the outside of a jail cell. Nobody was nearby. I was at least 6 feet away, which is well beyond its range anyway. And that device was literally spiking one after another as we're trying to get ready. And that's one thing that we've noticed as we're doing investigation. It's almost like if there is a ghost there, he's playing with us because he knows we're not set up. We don't have the cameras going. Mm-hmm. We're in the process of setting it up, and he's saying, here we are, and we're going to play with the tri-field meter, but you're not going to capture us on video or anything else. And then by the time we get it all set up, of course, the tri-field calms back down to normal.
Yeah, it's interesting when you first go into a location. Often that's when you'll get your best EVPs and even some other things. Cool. So what kind of, as far as this Geist box, Ned, a couple of questions. Do you have more than one polling box? Is it all contained in one unit?
Yeah, basically it's one, it's smaller than a bread box, as they say. it's actually smaller than most laptop computers. It's maybe about half the size of a laptop computer. And, basically, everything can be, we can hook up as many as 8 units or 8 different devices in there, and actually we can, we have the capability of piggybacking them and actually making more than 8, but so far 8 seems to be sufficient for what we are using now and whatever we decide to adapt it to in the future. And they're all basically just little PC plugs. You know, they look sort of like telephone modular cables, pretty much, that just snap in there. And each device that we got, the tri-field and the Geiger counter and the negative ion detector also have those, or adapted to run off that the Geist program. And if you remember years ago, the Tim Hart with Mesa had a very similar device. Actually, I think Geist was just about a year before he came out with his Mesa and Mesa device, which is similar, which also does have picks up different fields. It's a multi-energy sensor array is what Mesa stands for, and it's kind of picks up infrared, visible light, EMF. I think it was a some sort of sensing device, sort of like a seismograph almost, and something else. And his is a little bit different in that he doesn't have a polling box. It just goes through, I believe, a computer, a laptop, and then he can print out the graph of each device,
right,
and show where the spikes were, in what time period, and so forth. And it can run, again, throughout the evening by itself. There is a, there was another unit that was being sold. It's still being sold. I don't remember what it's called. That's similar to Geist and Mesa. I've not actually worked with that, or had any feedback from people that have actually used that particular device. But I know in the EVP they have this new technology coming out. This unit called Frank's Box.
Right.
That sounds to be pretty amazing to me. It's something that we're going to be looking into. We've already developed a very low-cost experiment, or prototype, I should say, of that Frank's box using the Radio Shack radio, and the one that you can flip through manually, or you can actually put in the limiter itself where it does it automatically. It's not the real expensive one that they sell on the website, but it's the cheap one that most people can afford.
Yeah.
We've not yet had a chance to really use that or experiment with that, but I was able to earlier this year in June at the Lincoln Theater, part of the American Ghost Society Conference in Troy Taylor. We were down there with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who is a noted researcher and author, many books, and been in the field for a number of years. And she actually had one of the prototypes of Frank's box. I don't remember what number it was. But in doing some experiments with that, it actually called out the name of one of our researchers that was in the group by name twice, which was pretty amazing. And then when they said, "You mean the Joey that's here?" the response was, "Yeah, that's him." So it's kind of, I wasn't there when that was recorded, but we, you know, the people that were recording it right there was some of my group. And I listened to it later and I said, "That's pretty amazing."
Was so Joey a member of your group?
Pardon me?
Joey was a member of your group?
Correct, uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing to actually call out somebody by name and then actually almost like answer the question that we had posed to it.
Well, great. Well, we're going to take our last break. We're going to come back. We're going to finish our discussion with Dale Kaczmarek. Very interesting discussion on a number of topics that are of interest to paranormal researchers. So hang with us. We'll be back in just a few.
The West Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And we're back, folks, for our last half-hour segment on Paranexus Universe. We are talking with Dale Kaczmarek about a number of interesting topics. Mike, did you have a question on the Geist box or something else?
Well, actually, I was going to ask him, for all the viewers out there, what is your favorite field equipment to carry with you? You know, if you were just going to go out on a personal investigation, if you don't have the ability to have a Geist box.
Well, there's a number of basic devices that you can get that are in most people's price range, and if you can't afford a tri-field, they make a tri-field natural, EMF meter, and tri-field EM meter. They make like three different devices with three different designs, and some of those can be pretty pricey. There is a very nice Aspiri device, which is listed on my site, which goes for about $100. At least it was when I purchased it. It might have went up a little bit.
The digital one.
Exactly. And it's a very good device. Unfortunately, you have to, it doesn't give you any sound. You have to be looking at the digital readout as you're going around. But it's not quite as sensitive as the tri-field, which is good in some ways because you can kind of walk around with this, but it will give you some pretty good accurate readings. Now, we also do use another device that picks up temperature and humidity. It's a thermometer and a hygrometer. It's made by X-Tech, and again, if they go to my website under the test equipment page, all those devices are listed on there and where you can actually get them from. And some of them are very inexpensive.
That's ghostresearch.org.
That's very good to pick up not only temperature readings, but also give you humidity, which in itself, if its humidity is extremely high, obviously you'll get less static electricity. And some of the devices that, like negative ion detectors or electrostatic detectors, won't pick up that energy in the air because it's very humid. The drier the air would be, the more you'd pick that up. So those are a couple of my favorite devices. The Raytech non-contact thermometer gun is good, but a lot of people don't realize about that is that really gives you a contact reading, and it doesn't really give you an air temperature reading. So when people are getting a reading, they right away think they're hitting a cold spot, and they're really not. They're hitting, what happens is that sends out a beam of infrared light, which bounces off something, comes back, and gives you an instant reading. And it can be a tombstone, it could be a stove, it could be a light bulb or whatever, and it's going to give you whatever it bounces off of and not the air in between. So if you're looking for a contact reading, that's what you look for. If you're looking for a temperature reading, you need a traditional thermometer of some kind.
But you also need one that has got an instant read, too. Your ambient temperature thermometer, it's an instant read, I take it?
Yes, it is. And it does fluctuate in tenths of a degree. It is an inexpensive device. There are more expensive devices that are a bit more sensitive. But again, if you're limited by your budget, that might be what you could afford, at least at this point.
You can buy a $10 one at, heck, I even think Walmart sells them, but I know Home Depot does. They're one of those food thermometer types, but they do have an instant read. They're digital.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
So your forte is a lot of spirit photography. You want to tell us what you do with that?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by the images that show up on pictures, different types of media. I have all different types of cameras, some very antique ones, some I can't even get film for anymore, unfortunately. But I do have an old 126 Brownie, a 110 Instamatic. I got an OS-X70 Polaroid LAM camera. I have a couple of square shooters. Those are the ones that you used to just count 60 seconds and have to rip off the top of the Polaroid. If it was too cold,
right,
you had to put it in a container and hold it in your hand so it would develop properly. And then I have a couple of old 35 millimeters. I'm working with some digital photography now, and of course, you know, camcorders and digital camcorders. But I've always found it fascinating that people get images of what I call extras or photographic extras, sometimes in very ordinary film or very ordinary circumstances they may be under. And through my website, I get an average of about 5 or 6 photographs a day. I've literally been bombarded by people sending me images, which I do look at for free and give you my opinion. I guess people have to remember this is just my opinion, so if I burst your bubble, I'm not doing that on purpose. I'm giving you my opinion of what may be there, so take that for what it's worth. But I've seen so many examples in the past that there are a lot of false positives or false ways that things can show up on film that really are not ghosts at all. And you have to be careful and be very aware of the circumstances under which you take your pictures. Now, a lot of times, people can photograph your camera strap, which looks like a vortex or a spiral of some kind. I have so many examples, and I do a very nice presentation that shows the false positives, and I could probably show you about 70 or 80, maybe more than that, actually, of camera straps, and they all look the same. They're basically very white, because usually they are the closest thing to the flash. Camera straps, for the most part, are usually black, but when they're bleached out, when they're hit by that flash glare, they turn white, and they have serrated edges, very much like a steak knife, and you can very easily tell a camera strap or a wrist strap when it's photographed. And unfortunately, there are sites out there that say that these are ghosts, so you have to know, especially be aware of where your camera strap is all the time. It usually doesn't happen if it's around your neck or off the camera, or if you're taking what's called a horizontal picture. The problem happens when you take a vertical picture and you tilt the camera with the camera strap not around your neck anymore, either 90 degrees to the left or the right, and the camera strap has a tendency then to dangle in front of the camera lens and can be snapped accidentally. Of course, there's double exposures. There is simply bugs or insects. If you go out at night to a forest preserve or a cemetery in the summertime and you snap a picture of a flash, you might see insects and bugs floating around, which is like orbs. And they're not orbs at all. They're just simply bugs or insects. Shake a dusty rag in front of your camera and snap a picture, and you'll see thousands of orbs. These are just some of the things that I see that people send me. Mists very often are one thing that I get a lot of. And sometimes it's just as easy to have a trained eye. If you given a picture, and there's a strange fog in it. And if you look very carefully and zoom around the picture, about 50% of the time, you're going to see an ashtray or a cigarette in someone's hand nearby, and that's what caused that to happen. Because cigarette smoke, even though it's invisible to the naked eye, does linger in the air for a while, and it may not be visible. But try it yourself, and you'll easily see that you can get that reflection of light mist off the cigarette smoke. If you go out at night in the dead of winter, you can easily photograph your own exhaled breath that might come in front of the camera and be illuminated by the flash. So it's a good idea to kind of hold your breath if you're doing something in extremely cold conditions. So these are kind of many of the false positives. And if I seem like I bash orbs, I kind of do, because especially with the digital technology. Digital technology, when you're out literally photographing in the total darkness and there's really nothing, even sometimes for your infrared light that goes out there to try to get your automatic focus to focus on, and it just will snap a picture of nothingness. And sometimes perfectly round, semi-transparent circles will show up, known as orbs, and they're really nothing more than a digital flaw caused by lack of pixelization of those pixels filling in on that digital print, or that digital file, I should say. So digitals are great, don't get me wrong, because they do give you that instant picture. And the biggest thing with the use of 35 millimeter is you always have to wait to get the film back, so you don't know if something was there at the time. With a digital, you'll know instantly if you got something. So we use digitals in conjunction with our 35s. What we try to do in most cases, and this is something that is usually beyond what most people, most researchers might do, because it might be kind of hard to find a film nowadays, but infrared film is something that if you can find it still, if you can find a lab that will develop it, it's something that you should explore. There is a file on my website that explains a bit about infrared film, the safeguards that you have to watch for, because number one, it is infrared film, so it's sensitive to heat. It must be kept refrigerated before you use it. You got to take it out of the freezer or refrigerator, let it thaw to room temperature, or warm to room temperature. You shouldn't freeze the film. You know, these keep it cool. For about an hour or so, you don't put it in and fog the film inside the camera. And then it must be loaded and unloaded in total darkness and not just subdued light. So you literally have to go into either a dark room, get a what they call a glove or a changing bag. You put the entire camera into a dark bag and you can put the film in there on the, or very, very dark closet where there's no light at all. But then you have to know how your inside your camera is. You have to know how to properly load your film and get it in there. And then the same thing when you take it out and you send it to the lab, make sure you always tape the canister shut that you put it into, because the first thing they always want to do is pop open the canister and take that roll of film out of there. And that little cartridge that the film winds back into is not always guaranteed to be absolutely light tight. And any light striking or prematurely striking that undeveloped film can cause a lot of weird images on it. And you might think you've gotten a ghost. But the best way to use infrared film, and we've gotten a lot of good results in the past, is to use that in conjunction with another high-speed 35-millimeter film, usually either 400 or 1,000-speed film, or what's known as Tri-X black-and-white film, which is very sensitive to the UV, the ultraviolet end of the spectrum, as well. And if you were able to set up two 35-millimeter cameras of a given location and snap simultaneous pictures using separate tripods, separate cable releases, and try to snap both pictures at the same instant, and then later compare those images, we've gotten some good results. A lot of times things will show up on the infrared film that have not shown up on the high-speed film taken at the very same time. And then that's usually an indicator of something being there.
We've been experimenting with infrared, but not with the film, but with the filter on a camera.
Yes.
Now you can screw an infrared filter on, and that's given some interesting results. And like you do, you have a separate camera. We take a control shot of the room, and then we'll put that filter on, and we've gotten some interesting results. We're still testing it out, but infrared's it's a beautiful photography form anyway. I mean, if you put one of those filters on and go take some pictures out in the sunlight of trees and so forth, they turn out beautiful. Very neat
form of photography. There's two different types of 35mm film you can get. You can get the black and white, which is what I recommend most people use, or you can get the Ektachrome 36 exposure slide infrared film, but that is really bizarre colors. When you take it outdoors normally on a brilliant lit sunny day, the grass will all turn red without a filter. The shade will be like bluish to purple and different colors in between, so it's really kind of hard to distinguish within all the weird colors. And of course, if you're using different filters to filter out certain colors, the whole idea of filters is you're restricting certain light from striking the lens. Strike the media and the lens, obviously. So you're limiting what is coming into the camera, which I'd rather not do because we don't know precisely what the ghosts are on. So by putting a filter on, you might be just filtering out the ghost that you're trying to photograph to begin with. But
there's a question.
Good results.
There's a question in chat, aside from what you've already discussed on some like the camera strap and so forth, is there any good way to get a photo in terms of spirit photography? Anything else to add to that?
In my book on Field Guide to Spirit Photography, I got an entire chapter devoted on bettering your chances to get something on film. And there are several different ways of doing this. Now, number one, again, if you have specialized equipment, tri-field, negative ion detector, some other device, and you're getting a reading, well, obviously that's an indicator something might be there. Snap a picture. If you are with a psychic person or you're intuitive yourself and you feel something, hear something, smell something, you snap a picture. Or, better yet, if you don't have a good psychic, bring an animal, like a dog or a cat, to a location that you believe to be haunted or a place that you're doing research on. And if that dog or cat reacts strangely to an area, you can snap a picture because animals are very sensitive to picking up that type of phenomena, especially cats and dogs. There have been many examples we're doing investigations with that had pets involved, that pets either saw something, followed things with their eyes, shot out of the room, barked, snarled, growled, hissed, and no matter how you try to coax them back into the room, usually in trying to get scratched up at the same time if it was a cat, that happened to me one time, they won't go back in there because they sense something. But one way would be obviously to find a location where you can, in your neighborhood or your city or state, that has a reputation for being haunted to begin with, and then employ one of these methods that I spoke of to better your chances of getting something. And again, you don't have to have a fancy camera or a fancy film to get a spirit image. I have examples on every different type of film that I spoke of earlier, from 126 to 110, 35, digital, Polaroid film. And all different types of different 35mm films, including digital cameras as well, and camcorders. So it's just a matter of, again, being there at the right place at the right time. And if I was to show you how many rolls of exposed film I have, absolutely nothing, I would fill a library. So
yeah,
it takes a lot of patience and perseverance.
All right, so we got just a few minutes left. And in that time, what message would you like to get out to researchers to help them to aid them to something, maybe the culmination of things you've learned that you feel very strongly about, passionately about, just as a summarization?
Well, number one, watch for my book that's coming out called The Field Guide to Ghost Hunting Techniques, and buy that when it comes out, probably
and where
March
can they
or
get
April
that?
Next year. It'll be on my website.
Which but, is?
Pardon me? www.ghostresearch.org. But in general, most groups that are on the Internet have some sort of modus operandi or some sort of rules that they follow. I think every group, everybody that goes out to investigate should have some ground rules set out and, you know, do's and don'ts of things that you should not do and shouldn't do, or should or should do during an investigation. Like, you don't want to smoke, you don't want to drink alcohol, you definitely want to have permission to go to a site if it is private property, you don't want to trespass, and try to leave the location as you found it. You know, don't leave it a mess, don't film canisters, cans on the ground, paper, trash.
Cigarette butts.
Just rooms are for other people that try to investigate the site later. But just simple common sense guidelines and rules, and it's very easy to sit down and think of some of these when you're doing a site. And one thing is, you never want to go alone for two reasons. Number one, there's safety in numbers. And number two, if you do have a paranormal event, you do have another witness that may be with you that can also verify that as well. And it's not just a one-person sighting.
That's great. You've obviously had a lot of experience, a lot of cases, and had the opportunity to test out some interesting equipment as well. That's always a great thing. So your book's coming out. Ghostresearch.org is the website. And you've got other books out that they can also get information on your website, Windy City Ghosts and Windy City Ghosts 2. And what's the other two that you have?
The Field Guide to Spirit Photography and Illuminated Darkness, The Mystery of Spook Lights, which is basically a cross-country listing of different ghost lights and spook lights around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story in itself. Maybe we can get to it in another show.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing as well. Well, we appreciate you coming on. I wanted to, just in the short time we've got left, I just wanted to remind our listeners that the Paranexus Conference is coming up in a couple of weeks. We'd love to have you there. It's on Saturday, October 25th, 2008, in Tampa at the Comfort Inn Conference Center. It's really a nice little area there to have a conference in. We're looking forward to that. So we'd love to have you. More information is on paranexus.org. The registration fee is pretty low. It's $59 for members, $69 for non-members. However, if you're not a member, that's cool too, because with the early bird special, which is going on through October 15th, you also get a year membership with Paranexus. That's a $30 value, so that brings it down a little bit. And we are looking at the possibility of broadcasting the conference for like an online registration. So we'll be coming out with information on that in about a week or so. If you live in a different part of the country and you really just can't make it, you can still participate in the conference from that angle. We've also got the Paranexus Academy, which is new, where you can learn about different things. If you are a researcher and you really know a subject and you'd like to instruct a class, that would be great too. There's information on paranexusacademy.org. And we'd love to have some instructors. We'd love to have some students. We're really, really trying to make this a very economic way to further your education as it relates to the paranormal field. And that can cover everything we've talked about tonight, such as spirit photography, forensic audio analysis. It can be paranormal research. It can be just whatever, you know, getting the best EVPs. And it also goes into other areas, too. For example, In my CPI course, I talk a lot about self-concept. You know, the way you feel about yourself, it makes a big difference, and belief, and so on and so forth. A lot of that we've touched on tonight. So take a look at paranexus.academy.org as well as paranexus.org. And we've already announced this too, but don't forget the registry, the database where you can submit sighting reports. And it doesn't just cover hauntings either. It covers UFOs and cryptozoological events as well as abductions. So those things, we're trying to add more and more to Paranexus to make it very flexible and eclectic, if you will. We really appreciated having Dale Kaczmarek on. Dale, thanks so much for spending your time with us tonight. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Mike, appreciate you sitting in for Grant, who should be back next week. Now, next week, you'll really want to tune in. Just like tonight, we have another great program with Dr. David Jacobs, who is an alien abduction, really an expert. He's done a lot of work in that field, so we're really looking forward to that interview as well. So that's next week, next Thursday, and don't forget to look up, if you're in Alabama, on October 14th to see if that 200 to 300 mile wide UFO is going to be there. So, folks, we appreciate your time tonight as well. We look forward to seeing you again on our next show. Everybody, take care. Have a great night.
Good night, everybody.